Hey, Eric, you got any good jokes for me?
Well, you know, I do have a good joke for you. A good holiday joke. I don't know if it's a good joke.
Right. Well,
but it is a holiday joke.
Great. Okay, that's appropriate.
We'll see. You can decide.
Okay.
All right. So Santa Claus, this time of year, decided he could no longer hang out with the elves anymore. I know it was sad, but he just couldn't do it. And he went in and told Mrs. Claus, I can't hang out with the elves anymore because they're elfin crazy.
Welcome to Heal and Grow with Nikki. I'm your host, Nikki Kraminga Hill. Here we talk about everything: grief, hope, illness, work, family, tragedy, possibilities, fun stuff, and not so fun stuff. It's all on the table. Let's take a look at our lives and work to heal and grow together. I'm so glad you're here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Heal and Grow with Nikki. I have a very special guest today, Mr. Eric Paulson. Say hi, Eric.
Hello. And I'll add a woo-woo.
Woo-woo. To know him is to love him. Eric is my friend and my partner in shenanigans with Alive and Kickin', which we talk about all the time on this podcast. So that's how I met you. Yeah?
That is.
Or did I meet you before that? No, I think I met you at Alive and Kickin'.
It was, right? Yes. A couple of years ago when you came in to help with the show.
Yeah, I think it was April of 2022 is probably when I met you.
Well, we'll go with that.
We'll go with that. Well, let's go with that. No one's going to fact check us. And I didn't know then, but I do know now that you were brothers-in-law.
There we go.
Is that correct? With Michael Matthew Farrell, who I've talked about a lot on this show. He was my friend and mentor, and he was the one that got Alive and Kickin' going. So is that how you found out about Alive and Kickin'?
I did. Well, the first time I met Michael, I was dating his sister, so this would have been probably December of 1982. And Diane, Michael's mom and Mary's mom, took us out to eat at a place called Guadalajari's. It used to be in St. Anthony, Maine. And I met Michael there for the first time, and just, really enjoyed him, enjoyed his energy and his sense of humor and how we could both pick on his sister. And I had a partner in crime right from the beginning.
I'm sure Mary was like, oh, God. This again?
No, she's tough. She can handle it.
She can handle it. Okay. I'm going to read your bio real quick before we move on. A career educator, Eric graduated from the University of Minnesota Twin Cities in 1982. He taught for 2 years at St. Bartholomew School, in Wayzata, then returned to his alma mater, Richfield Public Schools, where he taught 5th and 6th grade for 11 years, then worked as an administrator for the next 22 years, wow, at both the elementary and high school levels. After retiring in 2017, he continued as a school bus driver for 5 years, and now is a drug mule for Capsule Pharmacy. I see their commercials all of the time.
Well,
there you go.
It's a good pharmacy. plug.
Eric's the guy delivering your drugs. He has been married to his wife, Mary, Michael Farrell's sister, for 40 years. They have 3 children, Chelsea, Carl, and Anders, and 3 grandchildren, Sophia, age 3, Olivia, age 2, and Graham, 1 year. He lied about his age and joined A&K in 2019. He has appeared in 3 A&K shows, plus Peace for the Ages, a collaboration with Stages Theater. He has worked in radio as a football and hockey analyst and for a time co-hosted the City of Richfield podcast. He has not written a book. He does not have his own podcast, but greatly admires people who have done these things. I've done those things. I can help you out.
Well, I greatly admire you, so seems like a lot of work to me.
Yeah, I mean, kind of a little bit, yeah. But you're an educator. I was only an educator for 5 years, like officially. I got my teaching license and taught in a public school for 5 years, and that is as long as I could hack it. So you did, what's 22 plus, what'd you say, 7? 30 some years you've been in education.
I think it was, well, 33, 34 years in schools. I just,
Oh my gosh, that's incredible.
Went there. I never learned how to get out. I never graduated. I went to the principal's office in seventh grade and never left.
Now, that was the thing that surprised me about you when I met you, is that, and it shouldn't, because I'm around educators all of the time, but you don't have the quote-unquote stereotypical principal attitude. Like, you're just this really, maybe I was, because I was always afraid of principals when I was little, like they were going to yell at me and suspend me or something, which never happened. But like, you're just so fun and sweet and funny and carefree. But maybe that's what made you, I bet you're a really good principal, just because you're so kind.
Well, I think that when you get to know principals, a lot of them are that way. I think they have that persona that you... that you just vocalized about that, but there are just certain aspects of that role that you need to have to be good at it, because you wear so many hats.
Right.
And you know, ultimately what you want to do is, you know, work for the kids and work for your students. Mm-hmm. But again, with your staff, and I was fortunate, I had wonderful people working for me. But it's like herding cats. So you have to have a lot of tricks in your bag to do that.
Right.
So I think once you get to know principals, I would feel that same way about district administrators.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, no sense of humor. What are these people? How boring are? But then I got to know them. I thought, wow, you people can be a riot too. So I think it's once you get to know people in those roles, you'll find out, yet yes, they are people other than,
right.
There are people, and the only thing I have different than teachers had was I could send you home.
Right. I didn't ever get to send a kid home.
That was the one thing that I could do differently.
I have a special fondness in my heart for educators, you know, just because I know what they go through, and I can only imagine how much more difficult it could be to be an administrator. Or maybe it's not that different. Like, what did you prefer? Did you not have a preference between teaching and administration?
Well, the biggest difference is when you're teaching, everything is guided by the clock.
Oh yeah.
You're doing this at this time, you're ending a lesson at this time, the kids have to be to this place at this time. Once you become an administrator, nothing is by the clock anymore.
Yeah.
Because the minute you think you have some time to do a certain task, boom, there's a crisis.
Right.
So you have to enjoy being able to put out fires. Another big difference is you get into education, most people do because they want to work with students.
Right.
And once you become an administrator, you really have to find avenues to work with students, because that's why you got into it in the first place.
Right.
And so my favorite time of the day at the high school level is I love doing lunch duty. Now, other people would be out there just cringing, but that's when I could talk to kids and develop relationships with kids on a casual basis. I thought that was phenomenal. Or yeah. Hall duty, because that's when I could touch base with kids and
just say hi.
How you doing? How's your day going? Take off your hat, take off your hood. Hey, I tell them I love wearing hats. Every minute I'm out of the school, I wear a hat. I can't do it in here, so
right.
I get it. So
right.
We have to ask you. And really, it's a safety thing. And you'd point out to kids, you'd say, look at these cameras. Now, the majority of these cameras at that time were in black and white.
Sure.
If you're wearing a hood or you're wearing a baseball hat, we can't necessarily tell if you're a student here in the school or someone who doesn't belong here. So it's really a safety issue.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure they really bought that.
Right.
But it does boil down to that. But that and suspending kids were the two worst parts of the job, was telling them to take their hats and hoods off or sending them home. Also, chaperoning dances was not one of my favorite activities.
I always roped my parents into chaperoning the dances. I don't know why they said yes.
Well, I remember doing that for my kids too, but I didn't have, at that point though, I didn't have to be And we really, at Richfield, we really prided ourselves on not having anything goes on the dance floor.
Yeah.
So I would be the one in there breaking. No, we don't do that here. You want to do that? Go to the club. We don't dance like that here.
We don't grind on each other at school.
Exactly. Right. So that became what my role was in chaperoning. So it's like, well, okay, but. You know, it's just one of those things. It's fun watching the kids have fun. But right. Again, you're kind of always sitting on that powder keg of, okay, something's going to happen.
Oh, my gosh.
Just waiting for it to happen. Right. When's it going to happen?
And always does.
Oh, always.
Oh, what a horrible way to, like, have to go through work. Like, always, like, something's going to be around the corner. Something's going to blow up in my face in a second. Where is it? Is there a way that I can anticipate it and shut it down and...
And it's not, then that's not everybody's cup of tea to do that. Right. So you have to be comfortable with that part of that where something is going to happen and you just have to wait for it to happen and then deal with the aftermath of that. But I was very fortunate. I was never involved in a school shooting. I never had to go through any of that. Mm-hmm. Richfield was a wonderful place for me to have my career at. We had great kids, great families. So, you know, I really don't have bad memories of that whole time.
Did your kids grow up through the Richfield school system too?
No, my kids went to Bloomington.
Ah.
So, and I really didn't want them to go to school with me being the principal.
Yeah. That'd be kind of weird.
At that school. So, no, they never had to do that. I know they do that in outstate all the time, but we're not going
to
do that.
If you don't have to.
Right.
Right. So, the reason why you're here, besides just chatting and talking about shenanigans with me, shenanigans is one of my favorite words. I accidentally said it one time at Alive and Kickin', and it stuck. And so, shenanigans just means fun or doing things that you're not supposed to do.
There is some of that, yes.
But Eric's going to chat with us today about one of his kiddos who, I mean, I'll let you talk about it and intro all of it, and then I'll just interject with all of my questions and comments. But one of his kiddos is a recovering drug addict, and Eric has just this really interesting perspective from being on the parental side of that. Typically, we hear these stories and we hear it from the kid's side, the child's side. But we don't really ask, like, how did that affect you and your family and, you know, and how is your relationship with your son now? So why don't you go ahead and just start chatting with us about that?
Well, and just so we know, I did ask my son, because this is his story to share. But I told him what I'd be doing, and he's fine. He was fine. Yeah, go ahead.
I love that, which is a testament to your relationship.
Yeah. He said, fine. Really? That's fine. Go ahead. And, but I did make sure I did get his permission to be able to talk about that. Well, so our son, our youngest one, was not necessarily the typical suburban, story, how he got involved with drugs. Like a lot of kids in high school, they'll experiment with, you know, starting with alcohol or starting with chew. And then try different things and other things. And in his case, he had a friend whose dad was going through terminal cancer, but also had a desk full drawer of OxyContin.
Wow.
So the son would grab some OxyContins and all of a sudden pass those around. Yeah. And again, one of those things with addiction is people will find what, they'll find their drug of choice.
Yeah.
And then that's the one that triggers that if you do suffer from addiction, which is a disease. It is not a personality or character flaw.
Amen to that.
It's been classified as a disease since the 50s.
Oh, really? I didn't realize it was that long.
People don't think that, though.
Right.
And we'll get into that. Right.
What's wrong with you?
Yeah. Or you're just a weak person. Yeah. So then, he, you know, that experiment with those, and he kind of found the drug that he liked in that. And when we didn't really have, you know, we had some warning signs, but I think like most parents, you kind of, I don't want to say gloss over them, but you maybe excuse them for other things and yeah. you have blinders on. I think he had an underage drinking piece his junior year in high school, between his junior and senior year. And it's like, well, okay, you know, when I was a kid in high school, their high school kids do this, experiment with that.
Right.
Those kids. Kinds of things. Yeah. And so we, okay, well, this is just growing up. You'll go to college and yeah, this will happen. And you'll get that all sorted out. This is just stuff that kids do.
Just kid stuff. Yeah.
That way. And so that's kind of how his mom and I, you know, thought about that at that point in time, with that. And we really didn't have, we look back on it and there were plenty of red flags now when we look back on that, but going sure. through it, you don't know those red flags, or you tend to minimize
yeah.
some of what those red flags are. That way, okay, we'll get him through the summer, we'll get him off to school, and he'll love college, you know, the freedom of college, he'll love all that. And he was a smart kid. I mean, he walked in to take his ACT, and I'm sure he was probably hungover when he took it, and walked in and walked out of there with a 33.
Right,
and
so.
Had a full business ride to the Lubar School of Business at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Wow.
Without,
so he was still doing, you know, even if he was doing drugs or drinking or whatever, he was high functioning.
Yes.
Yeah. Nothing yeah, to really but he be was concerned
a,
about.
Right. He was a kid whose school came easy to him uh-huh. That way. So he really didn't have to put in a ton of work at it. So school was fine. So it wasn't an issue of grades. His senior year, he opted to go to Normandale for his senior year.
Yeah.
Instead of staying at high school, he went there and that's what he wanted to do. And of course, we were supportive of that. We're supportive parents. Okay, go to that. And then one of the red flags was, I believe, in an English class, he ended up getting a D. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't
not typical
him. So then it's one of those things where, no, you're not probably even going to yeah. class. And at that point, you can't get a lot of information when they're there at Norman about your kids.
Right.
A lot of that school type, they're not telling you, hey, your kid's not showing up at not the high school, they would.
Right. But not
but once they're at
community college.
No, community college, that didn't necessarily happen. But he made it through. And okay, well, senior, again, another excuse. Well, senior slide.
Sure.
This and that, you know, all that made sense. So we get him graduated. He, you know, he'd work in the summer, but he'd also stay out a lot. But he was holding, you know, hold down a job. But okay, well, this is your senior summer, your last summer. You're going to have fun. You're having fun. These kinds of things. And then we're going off to college. And I think he has said the first time he tried heroin was the day before he left for college.
Wow.
The day before I brought him to Milwaukee to start school.
Yeah.
And he didn't, he was there and he was successful in school. Now he'd party like a, like freshman and,
right. yeah.
and do that. And, but he was, again, you know, school was successful. He's on the dean's list. So, okay, well, as long as you're getting decent grades and we're not getting calls from the police or from the school, things must
everything
be going
must be
well,
fine. Right.
You know, things must be going well. So he comes home for Christmas break, for winter break, and and he was downstairs in our house, and Mary, my wife, comes up and says, well, hey, Eric, you got to come downstairs. Something's going on with Anders. So I get up, and I go walking downstairs, and you can tell he's just out of it,
yeah.
just higher than a kite. And there were, you know, evidence that this was not just a drinking type thing. So I haul him into Fairview, downtown, and kind of, you know, sit there in an emergency room with him for 5-6 hours till he comes down out of this. And, you know,
and was
okay.
he able to tell you what was happening? I mean, you just knew, okay.
No, he was
high.
Right. He was in kind of that nodding off stage
gotcha.
That happens to,
okay.
to,
okay.
heroin addicts. Right. And it went down. We kind of just sat through it till he got out of that emergency room. They really didn't do anything for him. He wasn't overdosing or anything.
Oh, sure. So they're like, there's nothing. We can't really help.
So you're just going to sit here.
Just hang out here so you can be safe.
Right.
But, oh, wow.
But now we knew kind of what was going on. Yeah. And of course, we were naive enough to, well, Anders, you're never going to do that again, right?
He's like, oh, no.
No, I won't do that again. I'll never do it. Okay, well, we're going to send you back to school.
Right.
But knowing, hey, we're concerned, but you're never going to do that again, right?
Right.
No, I won't. Wow. So, here he goes back off to school and, again, does well in school, or makes it, and I'm not saying well, but makes it through. It's not,
yeah,
this is his freshman year, right?
Fine.
Everything's fine at that point. Well, in our mind, out of sight, out of mind. Okay. What's he really doing? We don't really know. We're assuming it's okay because we're not getting information otherwise. Well, then he comes home for the summer. And I think that's probably the first time he went in his first treatment program that he went in down, I believe, at Fairview, and lasted like 2 or 3 days and then made up some excuse to get out of there.
Did he go to treatment because he wanted to or because you asked him to?
I think it was a combination.
Sure.
Of that. I'm not sure he wanted to. I think his wanting to is, okay, this will maybe take some heat off me from mom and dad.
Yeah, it shows that I'm
taking
care of it.
Right, that I'm doing this. And he talks about that first treatment program as, oh, he said, I knew right away I was going to use
out of here
the whole time.
Wow, so he used during treatment.
Well, he knew right away once he got out, as soon as he could, he would use again.
Got it.
Okay, so he lasted about 3 days
and got him treatment.
Right. Got himself kicked out.
Okay.
And then, of course, always would assure us, no, I'm not doing anything. I'm not using, I'm not doing that. And being the parents, we wanted to believe that.
Right.
But now we're getting evidence that things are progressing in this disease and, makes it through the summer. We send him back to school. I believe he came back that fall and went into and then at winter break, I think we put him in another treatment program. He was in and out of treatments probably about 7 or 8 times.
Okay.
Which is, you find out that's fairly typical.
Pretty typical. Right.
At that point. So our journey included, Fairview downtown, couple Hazeldens, Teen Challenge, 2 or 3 different outpatient programs, just trying to find what would work,
right,
thinking
fit.
This would be the next one.
Yeah.
And all along, Mary and I are becoming more aware of this, and you're into these are things you don't talk about with your neighbors or your friends.
Yeah.
You don't talk about your son having these issues. So there's really no one, and we've never dealt, well, I think we both have had addiction in the family, but not in something where we had a responsibility to that particular individual at that time.
Right.
Like you do with your a child.
Right. So you're in the middle of this, you and Mary are in the middle of this, and you can talk to each other about it, but there's really nowhere else you felt like you could.
No, not that we felt at that time that we could go.
And say, hey, who has experience with this that can help us out? Yeah,
exactly. And so you sit there and you go through all those things of, okay, what did we do wrong? What should we have done? What can we say to make him stop?
Right.
So those things just start to eat away at you.
Sure.
And then you also get to that point where, you're worried that, okay, when are we going to get that phone call in the middle of the night?
Of course. Just
knowing what's going on. And I remember going out with a pastor friend of mine and talking to him a little bit about that. He had inklings at this. And his first question to me was, are you prepared for your son to die?
Oh, wow.
That was his first question. But the phrasing of the question, are you meaning me,
right,
prepared for this to happen.
And how did you answer that?
I thought about it for a minute and I kind of looked at him and said, I don't know if you can be prepared,
right,
but I know that that's the reality.
That this is definitely a possibility.
Yes. And we had those conversations with them all the time. You know, eventually it got to be, okay, you get two things here. One, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Two, you're going to be in jail. That's what you're looking at. Because as this went on through those years, and it was probably 6 or 7 years as it went on, again, we became much more well-versed in what was happening.
Right.
And knew what was happening and going on. And so, and having different things that didn't work,
sure,
for us in dealing with him, what we felt didn't work, not knowing what we didn't know, had, yes, those conversations that, well, these are your two roads. Until we found Al-Anon.
Okay.
We eventually decided to attend Al-Anon, and Mary went to a different one and I went to one. We didn't go to the same group.
Right.
And after the first meeting, I went to a meeting in Bloomington. She went to one out in Burnsville. My group was three elderly women and me.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, this really isn't, I mean, this, I didn't.
Did you just feel like, well, yeah, I felt, this okay, is not yeah, for the, me.
Well, this is what this is. I'm not, you know, nothing. And then Mary came home just kind of gushing about her group.
Right.
And the amount of parents that were there. And so I said, well, I'm going to go to your group.
Yeah.
Now. And so we started attending Al-Anon meetings.
And at what point did you start attending? Like a few years into it? Like at what point in like this journey with Anders and just him trying to get in and out of treatment and everything, at what point did Al-Anon come in about?
Probably about the third year.
Okay.
So he's maybe around 20.
Okay.
Probably about the third year we were at just, you know, wit's end with what,
how do we what, help you?
Yeah,
how do we help ourselves?
Right.
What's going to happen?
Or we didn't even know the questions asked,
sure,
or anything about, sure, you know, helping yourself. And like a lot of people that go into that first Al-Anon meeting, okay, well, what I want answers of what can you tell me to do to get him to stop?
Sure.
I'm looking for that magic bullet we can't figure out. So what did, and that's not.
That's not what Al-Anon is.
No, and pretty soon we realized, no, this is not about that. This is about you,
right,
and how you deal with it and how you care for yourself,
yes,
while your child is going through this.
Yes.
And so that was a whole different way for us to look at that because we didn't know different.
Right.
That way that, oh, yeah, I guess we do have to take care of ourselves.
Right.
To be of any help. And so that began our Al-Anon journey with him.
Wow.
And really it was for us, how to keep us sane and healthy.
Right.
While he's going through this. Mm-hmm. And so it took a while to get into that mindset that, no, this is not about him. This is about you.
Right.
And how you're handling this. And of course, it gave you an outlet to meet with other parents that were going through the same thing that you're talking about in a safe space.
Yes.
Where
like, you, I'm not alone,
you could talk,
I'm not,
right, exactly. Yes. You could talk about these things and we'd walk out of meetings, the first few meetings would walk out and go, oh, well, at least he hasn't had problems with the law.
Sure, because you're hearing these stories,
right,
from other people.
Sure. Well, then enough, you know, a couple months later, boom. Okay, he's having problems.
He's having problems with the
legal
law.
Problems.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, well, at least he hasn't overdosed. Sure enough, a couple months later,
yeah,
you know, we get the overdose and the Narcan and that whole piece of that. So whenever we got smart and or just aware enough not to say, well, at least our child isn't doing that, because,
right,
invariably that's what would happen. Like, right, oh, well, ours, boy, but they're really having problems.
Yes.
Ours isn't that much right. of a problem. Well,
you can't do that comparative suffering right. bit because no, it never works it, out.
No, and it did not, because again, we would say something and sure enough,
it would happen.
We'd be having the same issues later on.
Right.
With that. So we would do the treatments and you'd go to different, and it was interesting. Our first treatment out in Hazleton, we did the youth one, which is out in Plymouth, I believe, by Armstrong High School.
Yeah.
And we did the parent week and they would come in and you'd see the kids. And so here you'd see these other kids, and these are good looking kids, athletic, smart.
Sure.
You know, and again, we're talking Hazleton. It's not like, you know, it's not like, you know, so these are parents that have insurance or have the financial means to put them resources to do that. But it was amazing that no, and you really did get the sense that no, this crosses, addiction is not a rich person, poor person, black, white,
right.
whatever race.
Addiction
issue.
Doesn't discriminate.
Nope, it does not discriminate.
Right.
And we really hit home when you saw that way, and just his journey through all that was very eye-opening for us. That again, you see these kids that seems like have everything right. in the world going for them.
Right.
You know, have stable families, have means, have you know, the world kind of is their oyster,
right.
except they have this disease.
Right.
And that impacts everything they do.
Right.
And we become, eventually you come to the realization that you can't do anything about it as a parent. So they talk a lot about that detaching with love.
Detaching with love.
And how do you do that?
Right.
That easy to say, really difficult to do.
To do.
But that's one of the cornerstones, is you have to detach with love. I mean, you still have to love your kid. I get that.
Right.
But you have zero control. Over how this is going to play out.
That's just got to be maddening.
It is. It's frustrating. But when you come to that realization and accept that,
right,
that makes those times where you're wondering about, you know, boy, what did we do wrong? Right. Where did we go wrong by this kid? What fault is it of ours? That makes those moments lessen.
Sure.
You still have those.
Yeah.
And boy, what, you know, how did he get into this? But it makes it gives you something to kind of rely on and say, you know, they're really, until they decide to get clean.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't. And you come to that realization that they have to decide before it kills them.
Wow.
And we were fortunate in that fentanyl wasn't a big thing at that time.
Right, like it is now.
Right, because these poor kids out there that take this stuff for the first time or whatever, and it kills them.
Right.
And they don't know what they're
doing. They don't know what they're doing. No. They don't know what they're saying yes to.
No, so... We and there was Narcan available, and so different, you know, little different journey now.
Sure.
Than back then, back when we were going through that. So you do look at things and look at, well, you know, you're really, there's something intervening in your life that he's still here.
Yeah.
That way. And, you know, it just, but it is a process. It is a process I wish on no other parent. But you have to look at, okay, maybe there's a reason Mary and I were selected to go through this. Mm. You know, maybe.
Do you think there was a reason?
I mean,
how can we really know?
How can we really know? Right. But maybe.
Maybe there were lessons in there right. that you all needed to learn.
Or that we were the right people for him at this time.
Right.
To go through this at right. this time. That other people, you know, that way. And so you have to look for those kinds of things too when you're. Sure. When you're in the throes
the
of this,
thick of that, you have to find yeah, some hope.
Yeah, you do. You have to. And that's, again, that goes back to Al-Anon.
Right.
You know, giving people that and talking about that and, you know, talking about finding, and it does, you know, finding some kind of higher power.
Right.
Doesn't necessarily have to be a Christian higher power or right. Hindu. It could right. be the sun. Something. It could be the couch.
Right.
You have
I do
to
love
believe,
this couch I'm on.
Well, there you go. You have to believe mm-hmm. that something, that there is some kind of higher power and there's a reason that this is happening.
Yeah.
At least that helped us through the journey.
Yeah, they talk about that in AA too. I'm not really a member of AA necessarily, but I'm not. I'm, you know, my sober journey is just whatever it takes, you know. So sometimes it's AA, sometimes it's a different meeting, sometimes it's a reading or something like that. But I know that it puts a lot of people off to talk about higher power sometimes, but I'm definitely someone who believes in higher power, or somebody said once, Gus. God, universe, source. Mm-hmm. So I'll be like, I believe in Gus or, you know, but I do believe that there's something, whether it's an energy, spirit, mm-hmm. creation, whatever, outside of me that is helping me along, you know? I think that people can get clean without that, you know? But for me, it's just been easier to have something else, you know? And so to hear you talk about Al-Anon, I went to Al-Anon once. I should have probably gone back, but I didn't have a good experience.
Maybe you were with the same three older laters that I was with in Bloomington.
Yeah, I went once. I still remember it very well. I think I was in my late 20s to just kind of talk about. It was when I was finally accepting the fact that my dad had an alcohol problem, that my dad was an alcoholic, because I had denied that for so long. And I think I just wasn't ready for it at the time because, you know, people want you to, like, you don't have to talk if you don't want to. And I didn't want to, so no one made me. Mm-hmm. But I sort of felt like they really want me to talk and I don't want to and I'm not ready. Whereas now I'd probably go back and be like, let me just lead this damn meeting, you know, but that. You know, people are afraid to go to the 12-step programs, I think. And really, it's the most difficult part is getting off the couch and driving yourself to the meeting. Because once you're there, everything is taken care of. You know, you could participate mm-hmm. as much or as little as you'd like. You know, if you like stale coffee, it's great. I mean, how did you guys even know about Al-Anon? Someone finally told you about it, or did you? Because this is what 30 years ago. 40, like, how did you know about Al-Anon?
Well, it wasn't necessarily 30 years ago, okay. But we probably started attending Al-Anon meetings in. Andrew just graduated in high school in 2012.
Okay.
So 2015.
Okay. So not 30
years. Probably. Well, yes.
I don't know.
What, yes. Well, I'm not math. Sure what that would have been.
Because, so could you even, because I was thinking at the time, did you just go to Google and you were like, how do I find help? Or
some of that in some of the treatment things, because a lot of the treatment portions have a parent component.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Especially when they're younger.
Sure.
Once your child hits like 21 or so, then that's not. But between that, you know, that when they're a little younger, though, and a lot of people there would say, advocate going to Al-Anon. Okay. So we were aware of what the name
what it was.
Then just doing a little more research okay. on our own, looking, you know, looking it up and looking at things. than that, okay, well, we need to try something.
Something else.
To help us get through this for ourselves.
Right.
That way. And, or something that will help him. Like I said before, you know, we went in there, okay, well, what did you guys do to get your son to stop doing this? Right. That's what we want to know.
Of course.
And you'd see new parents come in and that's what they want.
Right.
They want that right. silver bullet. And then you learn, no, it's not about that. This is about you. It's not about them.
So tell us the rest. So Anders is not clean.
Mm-hmm.
What was that process like for all of you?
Well, that's very interesting because I think it's interesting. Hopefully your listeners will find it interesting. But Anders, he's an introvert, and you have to peel away the onion yeah. to get to his core. And his last treatment was Teen Challenge.
Okay.
Now, Teen Challenge is one of the treatments with a Christian component.
Okay.
With a God component.
I didn't know that. I've heard of Teen Challenge.
Because the other ones don't really have that
okay.
as a component. Teen Challenge does.
Okay.
And that was his last treatment. Now, let's go back a little bit before that. Probably the last 3 years that he was using, I would say that he was probably sober 90% of the time.
Okay.
And this is where a piece where he'd fall off the wagon for a week.
Sure.
Then he'd recover and go to a different treatment, go to outpatient, something like that. Yeah. And then a few months later, he'd relapse.
Yeah.
And then, so that kind of thought, okay, this is going to be the circle. He'll be clean for a while, then he'll relapse.
Right.
But then again, okay, which time do you relapse that you're taking something that kills you?
Right.
Piece of that. But probably like the last 3 years that he was in the throes of this, which was probably about 7 years total, he was probably sober 90% of the time.
Yeah.
With that. So he knew what it was like to be sober.
Right.
But with opioids, it takes you a while to get your head clear.
I'm sure.
You're in a fog for quite a lot. So it takes yeah. you a while to think straight. Those are his words. So his last treatment was at Teen Challenge. Mary and I were attending a wedding in California, and I get a call Sunday afternoon. Hey, Dad, I left Teen Challenge. I'm at home. Like, oh my goodness, we weren't coming flying home till Tuesday.
Right.
And immediately it's, but no, I've got a plan. Okay. I've got a plan. Okay, well, we make arrangements and fly home as early as we can with that. And he did. He had a plan. He was checking into a different a halfway house and working out of that. And he had it all planned out. He had just kind of had enough of Teen Challenge at that time.
Sure. Okay. That makes sense.
And he did. He had a plan, and that was his plan. So he's been, next weekend will be his fourth year.
Oh, my
celebrating
goodness.
Being sober.
Congratulations,
and
Anders.
He
and
his fiance, they have Sophia,
yeah.
who's three. And she's just been a joy in our lives and in their lives. But it's interesting because I'll ask him, what eventually got you to stop?
Right. What was the thing?
And again, as a kid, you peel away the onion. So the first answer was, well, it's just got to be such a hassle to live that way.
Yeah.
To worry about, okay, where am I going to get the money? Because we went through, you know, our things being pawned, taking stuff, pawning it. We went through all that in those years. Kicking them out of the house, driving them somewhere, dropping them off. You can't stay here. We did all those pieces.
I'm sure. Oh my gosh.
He said, it just got to be a hassle to live like that. I just got tired of living like that. Really? That's it? You just got tired of living like that?
Right.
You know, I'm thinking, okay, there's got to be something a little deeper than that.
Yeah, that didn't really resonate with you.
No, it just got to be a hassle where I was going to get money and where I was going to get the stuff. And
yeah.
It just got to be a hassle. Okay, but then talking a little more, he said something that really struck a chord with me. And he said, you know, what would happen was, he said, I couldn't forgive myself. Mm. I would go out, I'd be high, and I would do something stupid, or say stupid things or whatever, and then I couldn't forgive myself for what I've done. Wow. So then I would just keep using mask it.
Yep.
He said, until, and now these are his words,
yeah.
and this is him. This is an individual story.
Yep.
He said, until Jesus forgave me,
wow.
then I could forgive myself.
Wow.
And then I could move forward. And wow. That just struck me as, and we're not overly religious people.
Yeah.
You know, we'd bring our kids to church and,
sure.
and do that.
Sure.
And then, you know, hey, this is your journey from now on, you know,
right.
at this point. But that really, you know, that struck me as, okay, until I could forgive myself.
Yeah.
Or somebody could forgive,
someone
could
forgive me,
I could forgive myself.
Right.
Finally, I could move forward.
Right.
And not think about how I had hurt people.
Right.
Because that would just keep me in the circle.
You're going to stay in that loop.
And again, this is only probably within the last 2 or 3 months that he's expressed it that way.
What an incredible story.
But I think that's got a lot of truth to it for him.
Yeah.
Again, this is his journey.
Well,
it's not everybody's journey.
No. But at the end of the day, does it matter? Like maybe for Andrews, it's Jesus. You know, maybe for me, like I'm coming up on 1 year sober from alcohol. You know, for me, it was, I'm hurting my family. I'm seeing now that I'm hurting more than just myself. Cause when I was only hurting me, I was okay with that. But when I saw that I was about to hurt or maybe kill other people, you know, so it doesn't matter if it's whatever your reasons are. That's your reason, you know, and then that's okay.
And it's, I think, being self-aware enough to reflect and have that reason.
Right.
And again, you're absolutely right. Whatever that reason is, or whatever, however you get that self-awareness, be it through a higher power or through anything else.
Right.
Finally, he made the decision on his own to get sober. And until a person does that, everything else outside of that, what Mary and I found out, is just noise to them. And maybe making it worse, because now it's, in his case, giving him more to feel bad about. So I'm just going to use to mask the pain.
Right. Yeah.
But you don't know that. You think, you know, hey, we're trying to be real with you here, and we're trying to be helpful, but because we're not, you know, having you live at home, and we can't have you live at home because we know that that's not good for you. Just would sit downstairs and just think. And I'm sure I know there was a story about, I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was Paul Westerberg from The Replacements or whatever. He said, I only tried heroin 5 or 6 times. But he said, I still think about it every day.
Yeah. I mean, the power.
I can't imagine what Andrews was thinking about.
Right.
Sitting downstairs. And somebody, you know, akin that to, well, just stop. Well, all right. How does that work in your body if you want to stop diarrhea? It's kind of like that.
Right.
How does that work?
Just
telling
it.
You to stop.
Right.
And not having gone through what he's gone through, that's really difficult for me to put myself in his shoes, because I don't have an inkling
of
what his experiences or what he's thinking about or what his demons are.
Right.
And so that's difficult too. So again, the Al-Anon piece is very much, you need to take care of yourself, because you can't do that for the addict.
You can only control so much.
Exactly.
Right? You can only control yourself and how you are viewing everything, you know, and that's a hard thing for me. I like to control everything.
Well,
I just can't.
that is difficult for a lot of people because in a lot of pieces of their life, they have control.
Right.
And it's worked for them.
Right.
And all of a sudden you get to something where you have no control. And for a person that needs that,
yeah,
or thrives on that, it's really difficult. In fact, I have a couple. I brought the One Day at a Time Al-Anon book because there are two things that really resonate to me.
Yeah, share with
us. Out of the book. The first one deals with expectations. I'll just read the today's reminder piece. I will not set a pattern based on my own experience and wishes and expect someone else to live up to it. This is interference of a subtle and damaging kind. It damages my peace of mind and dignity and those I am smothering with my expectations.
Whoa, 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 whoa. That just kind of blew my mind.
I mean, it's crazy. And, right. and I think it's spot on is where when we start putting our expectations on somebody else and how they should behave, all we're doing is setting a trap for ourselves.
Right. We're just going to fail.
Yeah. It's not going to work. And it just isn't going to work. And I think that goes along with the control piece.
Right.
That if I put these pieces in place, I can expect you to act a certain way or behave a certain way. Doesn't work that way.
It doesn't.
No. And it takes, but I mean, that kind of phrase when we got to that, you know, hit me like a lightning bolt.
Right.
That,
you're like, how true. Wow.
That is.
I've been doing this. It wasn't my intention, but I've been doing it.
Exactly.
You
fall into that. And then.
Yes.
Again, it's that self-awareness piece that, okay, I'm casting my expectations on another person and how they should do that or not do that. Again, you're setting yourself up to fail.
Right. Right. And you're setting up your relationship with that other person to fail.
Exactly. Right. The other one, if I can blow your mind again.
I'll be making this purchase after you leave.
It's about trying to find the right place here. It's about being a perfectionist.
Okay.
And it says this, setting our goals too high can lead to frustration and worse. The perfectionist clinging stubbornly to, and this is written, this is, I'm reading the pronouns as they're written.
Okay.
Stubbornly to her ideas of what life ought to be, often has difficulty grasping both the acceptance and detachment elements of the Al-Anon program. She demands too much of herself and of, in this case, end of the alcoholic partner.
Yeah.
So it's a way about, again, expectation and perfectionism, how they really are setting a trap up, for
all of us.
For all of us.
I mean, regardless of what we're talking about, like I think about it being the new year soon, and I'm not much of a New Year's resolution person.
I remember you're not much or something. One of your previous podcasts, this is a tough time of year for you.
It really is because I put a lot of pressure on myself, but it's also a reflective time too. Like it's both end where I get really reflective and I actually lately I've been thinking about this has actually been a very good year for me and just, you know, I'm feeling better than I did a year ago. But it also is why didn't you get this thing done that you said that you were going to do? And I'm just thinking about, obviously your reading right now has to do with Al-Anon and alcoholism and usage and things like that. But I was just thinking of it as regular day-to-day expectations and perfectionism, things that I just can't attain because I'm a human being and no one can actually attain those things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we would have people in the group we were going to, their kids had been sober for 40 years.
Yeah.
They still went because it was just good life skills.
Right.
Good reminders and the thought of, okay, I'm giving back. Maybe I'm helping those next parents that are coming in here by sharing, no, get through this. You'll get through this. You know, here's some steps to help you if you want to go down that road.
Right.
That way. But you're right. I think like the holidays, the expectations we put on having, and I still fall into that. And on having this idyllic type holiday right. situation where everyone's together,
everyone's happy
yep. and I think that's why the holidays are so stressful to right. people, because they put those kinds of expectations on things instead of just, right. well, it's going to kind of be what it is.
It's going to be whatever it is.
Right. We're yeah. going to put the pieces in place. We're going to have a place. Okay. People are invited to come over.
Right.
But I can't control much more than that.
Right.
Of that.
Right.
And if people come over hurting or come over in a not great place, that's what happens.
That's not on you. That right.
No. And
yeah, we can take some of the pressure off of the holidays, you know, like we don't.
And again, it goes back to that, those expectations. Okay. We're going to have the Currier and Ives holiday.
Right.
Yeah.
That just sounds
exhausting.
And how
many people have that? How many people are so glad when they're done?
Well, that's a really good indication, is that if you are so glad that it's over, maybe we're doing something wrong. Well,
that's exactly right. Right. It is.
It's like, oh, I'm so glad this party's over or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. So tell me now, how is your relationship with Anders now? I mean, after listening to you, I'm sort of assuming it's exactly the same as it always was, right? You just love and care for this person to the best of your ability. You know, I kind of walked into this conversation not knowing too much and thinking, oh gosh, was there like a big blowout? Was there a, we don't talk to each other? But it just sounds like, no, you just loved him throughout the best that you could.
Well, I was talking to Mary before I came, and I said, well, what? This is the first time I've talked about this.
Really?
And I said, what? Yeah. I mean, the first time that I felt, and again, I asked his permission.
Right.
To do that, to kind of tell his story and our story along with that. And I asked, you know, Mary, what kind of message should we give? And she just looked at me and said, tell people, don't give up.
Don't give up.
Don't give up.
Don't give up on your kiddos. Yeah.
And that's what we did. We didn't give up. We learned not to cater to them, and we learned to detach from negative behaviors, but we didn't right. give up.
And I appreciate that you just differentiated there, you know, because I think some people, myself included to a certain extent, would hear don't give up and interpret that as cater to your child's everything, you know, like don't give up means I'm here for you. I support you. I love you. But it doesn't mean here, take all of our money and sure, I'll pick you up and drive you to the drug dealer's house and all of that. It just means we believe in you.
Absolutely. That's right.
Right.
You have to learn those other pieces. And that's right. what they call the detaching with love.
Detaching with love.
You know, we never gave up, and you never give up the hope that, okay, that he's going to, or your child's going to make it through this.
Right.
And unfortunately, a lot don't.
Right.
But again, that was, you know, don't give up. But again, but it's not that. And then that gets confused with the, oh, you need to love people unconditionally. And I would always go through this and, no, I've got conditions. Right. I'm not going to love you when you're using like
that's
that and
not
pulling your life apart. Well, that wasn't the way to, that's not the way to express it.
Right. Right.
It's just, we can't be a part of this behavior. Or enable this behavior.
We can't enable this behavior anymore.
And it took us a long time to learn that. And right. that's part of the not giving up.
Or even realizing, oh, I guess I was enabling you, but I didn't think that I was.
Right. Yes.
Just learning.
You don't know what you don't know.
Like. Right.
Until you
right.
get burned a few times and go, okay, well, this isn't working.
This isn't working.
How many times you came back to our house to live.
Right.
Until it was eventually, no, you can't come back here and live anymore because this is just not good for you.
Right.
We love you. You can't live here. Because we know what happens.
Right.
And I think our relationship is very, I think it's very much like you said, it's very much like it was.
Right.
It really didn't go through a crazy stage. But a lot of that, I give credit to him, because he could have let that go, well, I'm not going to see my parents or talk to my parents or do any of that, or, you know, drive a wedge in here.
Right.
And you really didn't. So, you know, our relationship really hasn't changed a lot. other than he now starts to look back on things and realize, and having a child of his own,
right, he has a kid now,
realizing, oh boy, some of the stuff I did, and he's alluded to, and he's, again, he's an he's introverted, so for him to come out and get deep with stuff is hard, but he said, boy, I must have put you guys through a lot. That way, but yeah, you did, but we love you through it all, right. And always will. So, and I said, and you know, you remember this when you're raising your daughter.
Right.
So, but again, this is our story. Mm-hmm. It's not everybody's story.
Right.
Everybody goes through this differently, and has their own pieces of that.
Right.
And it's definitely not a blueprint for how you deal with a kid in addiction. It's go out there. No, there isn't one. No, there isn't a form to do that. But there are support pieces out there for you as an individual.
Yes.
You know, they're not for, they're just for you internally. And know that to help you get through it. That way. Like, I know, the analogy is when you're riding the airplane and the person comes on, the stewardess is up there doing all the hand signals and they talk about the mask.
Yeah.
You have to remember, they say, you put the mask on yourself first.
Yep.
Then help.
Then you can help other people.
Other people. You can't help other people first and then think you're helping yourself. So that really
backfires.
No, that's right. And that really kind of sums up, the program and the Al-Anon program. I'm not a spokesperson for Al-Anon. It was a place for us to help us get through it.
I really appreciate that, because I feel like a lot of people don't share what their resources are, to hear that Al-Anon has been so beneficial for your family. I mean, I'll link it, y'all. I'm going to link this book in the show notes, and I'm going to buy myself a copy, and everyone should buy themselves a copy for the holiday season.
Well, there are a lot of great life lessons
that
make you think about, and it's really about how to live your life,
how to
relationships
live
with other people.
Right.
And it's not just necessarily a person that has an addiction disease. It's just how to live with other people and find peace for yourself.
Exactly.
Which is really difficult.
Oh, my gosh. This was incredible, Eric. Like, I am so glad that we did this. Thank you for coming over. Now I'm not going to be able to give you crap at Alive and Kicking anymore.
Oh, you still will. You still will. This will be short-lived, believe me. You still will. And I will still expect it. I would feel weird if that didn't happen. Then say, oh, God, what's wrong with Nikki?
What's wrong? Something's wrong. We know each other too well now.
Something's wrong.
No. Just thank you so much for being here.
And if this, the your podcast that gets millions of listeners,
millions.
I know that, yes. But if this can help one person go through and say, you know what, maybe I'll look into that, or maybe something out there can help me do that. If they want to reach out to you and you reach out to me, if
absolutely.
People need someone to talk to,
I can connect you for sure.
I've done that with people before. About things, but if again, it's one of those things where if this helps one person that's kind of going through something,
that's why
way worth it.
Sit down and chat about it.
Absolutely.
We talk about the yuck and how you get through it. I mean, I think that's just how we
it's heal and grow. That's right. And we didn't even get to how does his going through that affect the relationship with the two other siblings.
Oh, okay. We're going to have to do a part two.
So, I mean, because it's everybody.
Right.
Everybody's.
Right. It affects everything.
It affects the whole family.
Oh, my gosh. So. Super big time. We love to you, my friend.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being
Well, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Bye.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal, health, or professional advice. I am not responsible for any losses, damages, or liabilities that may arise from the use of this podcast. This podcast is not intended to replace professional medical advice.